Hey everyone, I'm Arun Venugopal in for Tanzina, and this is The Takeaway for July 1st, 2019. President Trump took an unprecedented step into North Korea over the weekend, but the White House still needs to deliver on actual nuclear diplomacy.
We've got nothing from Kim Jong-un. He still has 60 nuclear weapons with no promises to do anything more.
A former UN ambassador tells us what needs to happen next for successful negotiations with North Korea. Also on the show, we'll hear from a reporter who saw firsthand how China is targeting its Uyghur Muslim communities.
This is well over a million people locked up in what the DOD is calling concentration camps, and this is ethnic cleansing on a whole new level.
And a recent group of rock movies finds Hollywood mining the music of the 60s and 70s for modern audiences. We'll talk about it.
It's kind of a boomer thing. I think they're still the ones in power. That's why we're seeing all these rock docs, you know, about Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen and David Crosby. I mean, it's all still coming out, I think, because they're the ones who are calling the shots.
All right, folks, let's get to it.
For some reason, we have a certain chemistry or whatever.
Just received a beautiful letter from Kim Jong-un.
And they said, would you speak to the leader of North Korea? I said, absolutely, why not?
We are starting from a very high plane. We're starting from a very good relationship.
We had a historic meeting and decided to leave the past behind.
Stepping across that line was a great honor. A lot of progress has been made.
President Obama wanted to meet, and Chairman Kim would not meet him. The Obama administration was begging for a meeting.
But now there's this new reporting from the New York Times of a possible major concession by the Trump administration, something they said they would never consider before, allowing North Korea to keep its entire nuclear arsenal as long as they agree not to produce any new weapons.
I can talk him out of those damn nukes, because who the hell wants him to have nukes?
You've got to be honest about what it means to lead a country. It means killing people. A lot of countries commit atrocities, including a number that we're closely allied with.
I would invite him right now to the White House.
We understand each other. I do believe he understands me, and I think I maybe understand him. Sometimes that can lead to very good things.
President Trump's public overtures to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un reached a new level over the weekend.
We're seeing exactly the same pictures here of President Trump walking in between the blue huts. And in fact, there is Chairman Kim coming from the other side.
I've never expected to meet you at this place.
That's the sound of President Trump stepping across the border into North Korea from the demilitarized zone that divides the Korean Peninsula. He is the first sitting U.S. president to ever do so. It began as a last-minute Twitter request from Trump, and in the space of a day turned into that unprecedented and highly publicized moment. That was followed by a nearly hour-long meeting between the leaders, during which they reportedly agreed to resume nuclear talks, talks that have been stalled for months. Is this the path to real nuclear diplomacy or just a photo op? I'm Arun Venugopal, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Sung-Yoon Lee is a professor in Korean studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, and he's been carefully watching this all unfold. Professor, so nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Sung-Yoon, tell us first off your reaction to this meeting on Sunday. What struck you the most?
When President Trump intoned big moment, tremendous progress, well, he spoke the truth. Tremendous progress it was, a big moment it was for the North Korean tyrant. Kim Jong-un's game plan had all along been to ensnare President Trump into an open-ended process of negotiations without reaching a settlement, during which time Kim buys time, political cover, and money in the form of lax sanctions enforcement to further advance his lethal capabilities to grow his threat capacity to the region and ultimately to the U.S. mainland. So everything's going swimmingly for the North Korean leader.
You use a striking phrase in a new column you wrote for The Hill. In regards to North Korea, you cite the quote, weaponization of its weirdness. What do you mean by that?
When you look at the North Korean leader, I mean, you know, they're so bizarre. They're such a strange amalgamation of medieval mores. They're funny. They're weird. It really works to their advantage. Kim Jong-un's father, just like Kim Jong-un did, for the first 6 years upon inheriting power, never met with a single world leader, never traveled outside his country, was threatening, was considered a crazy lunatic. And then 6 years later, boom, Kim Jong-il in May 2000 shows up in China, receives the South Korean president in June, receives Vladimir Putin in July, sends a special envoy to Bill Clinton and so on. And when Kim the second, that is, visited China's special economic zones in January 2001, much of the world hailed the arrival of a North Korean reformer. It's exactly what has happened over the past 18 months or so with respect to Kim. Our propensity to patronize, make fun of North Korea is so strong, it's hard to take North Korea seriously. We see North Korea as a poor, paranoid player that would settle for a bit of civility or some economic goodies.
Now, in that same column for The Hill, you accuse the U.S. of practicing a certain kind of orientalism in terms of how it approaches North Korea. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, when you look at the conventional indices of measuring state power, political attractiveness, military power, economic power, the size of your population, territory, soft power, the United States is so overwhelmingly superior, it really is hard not to patronize North Korea. But you look at the scorecard on the ledger of nuclear diplomacy over the past nearly three decades, North Korea has reaped away from the world's biggest countries tens of billions of dollars, much of that in cash. For what? For repeated lies of denuclearization. And what has Team America gotten? A nuclear North Korea. You got to take them seriously.
Moon Jae-in of South Korea also met with the two leaders. Are Moon and Trump on the same page when it comes to negotiating with North Korea?
It's a strange marriage of convenience. Mr. Moon is a known entity. He was the chief of staff for a former South Korean president who was in office 2003 to 2008, during which time South Korea gave North Korea each year almost $1 billion, more than half of that in cash. It was unconditional, very generous kind of engagement. Where all that cash ended up is anyone's guess, but at the time, North Korea pursued a policy of military-first politics. So Mr. Moon comes from the far left on the political spectrum. The fact that there's been a convergence of interests between Mr. Moon and Mr. Trump is an oddity.
President Trump has been calling himself victorious on North Korea for quite some time, saying North Korea stopped nuclear tests and was sending back the remains of U.S. servicemen who were killed in the Korean War. That is misleading, but what do we know about what has actually happened in the time since negotiations last broke down?
Well, I mean, intuitively, on a fundamental level, it's much better to have handshakes, bonhomie, summit pageantry than mutual threats, escalation, and so on. But President Trump is selling as victory the past 18 months or so of non-serious weapons test. The last major test came in late November 2017. Well, by that low bar, then we should perhaps award two or three Nobel Peace Prizes to President Obama or President Bush, because there have been several three-year-long periods of non-weapons tests between 2006 and 2009, 2009 and 2012, 2013 and 2016. So it's a bit premature to celebrate the past year and a half of no serious weapons test as a victory.
Sung-Yoon Lee is a professor in Korean studies at Tufts University. Sung-Yoon, thank you so much for being on The Takeaway.
Thank you.
We're going to go now to former U.N. ambassador and governor of New Mexico, Bill Richardson, who has himself negotiated with North Korea. Governor, it's so great to have you back on the program.
Thank you.
Governor, can you give us your reaction to yesterday's performance? Did anything substantial come out of this impromptu meeting?
Well, nothing substantial came out. The good side was the president and Kim Jong-un obviously have a personal relationship that's good. There's less tension in the region. However, the bad side is he's legitimizing a despotic leader who has not given up anything on denuclearization or any promises he's made in the first negotiation.
Now, Governor Richardson, President Trump told reporters that President Obama had, quote, begged for a meeting with the North Korean leader and had been refused. Several former Obama administration officials have said that that is a lie. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the president is just not correct whatsoever. I was involved with the Obama administration, not as a member of their administration, in trying to bring political prisoners back, Otto Warmbier, some of the remains of our soldiers. There's no way President Obama wanted a meeting with Kim Jong-un. On the contrary, there was enormous hostility.
All right. I'd really like your take on where exactly we go from here. What needs to actually happen now, in your view?
Well, several things need to happen. One, the president and Kim Jong-un need to step aside from the negotiations because they just have photo ops. Secondly, the two teams need to develop a framework for negotiations. If a compromise is going to work, and I think a compromise is needed, the U.S. is going to have to get off their demand for full denuclearization from North Korea. They're not going to do it, but maybe they denuclearize some missiles, some nuclear weapons. Secondly, the sanctions relief. North Korea is not going to get the abolition of all sanctions, maybe get some. Go stage by stage, take several years, but find a negotiating framework that today doesn't exist.
Now, on a number of occasions, President Trump has made the pitch to Chairman Kim that these negotiations could lead to economic prosperity for North Korea. Is that, in your mind, a successful tactic for driving these negotiations to the next stage?
Well, what I believe Kim Jong-un wants is he wants to trade some of his nuclear weapons for an end of sanctions. Now, economic prosperity, yes, he wants American investment, European investment. I think that's possible way in the future. But Kim Jong-un has to improve his human rights record, has to respect private property, and he has to substantially denuclearize and stop threatening his neighbors like South Korea and Japan, principally Japan. And China needs to keep their sanctions on North Korea to keep the pressure on North Korea to negotiate seriously on denuclearizing.
Governor, you've shared, including on this show, concerns about a lack of Korea expertise in the president's cabinet and in his diplomatic corps. Where does that stand right now? Has there been any progress on that front?
Well, on the positive side, I think highly of Stephen Biegun, who is the North Korea negotiator. He's not a career officer, but he is a good negotiator and politician. I do worry about a lack of Asian expertise at the high level, ambassador, assistant secretary, on Asian issues at the State Department. The State Department has been stripped of our best diplomats. So I worry about that. I worry about expertise, not just with South Korea, with Japan, with North Korea, but I do think that Biegun is doing a good job, but the president has to back him up. And the president is not backing his negotiators. He wants photo ops. He wants summits. He wants historic moments. And it was a historic moment for the president to step into North Korea. But we have to have results. There's a lot of show and no results. The results are North Korea, get rid of some of your nuclear weapons, full inspections, get rid of some of your missiles, destroy them, but don't just talk and share the world stage with the President of the United States, which has always been a North Korean goal. He's been legitimized internationally and with his own people by these three summits.
The president has raised the possibility of inviting Kim to the White House. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that would be wildly premature. But I wouldn't put it past the president. You got to hand him the showmanship prize, but certainly not invite him to the White House until he commits to denuclearizing his weapons and denuclearizing his missiles and lessening tensions, improving human rights. That's the ultimate prize, a visit to the White House. Hold on to that. But I wonder what the president is going to do next. I can't wait.
Bill Richardson is former governor of New Mexico and former UN ambassador. He's been on the line with us from Geneva. Governor, thank you so much.
All the best. Thank you.
Hi, people. It's Arun Vanigopal in for Tanzina Vega most of this week. And I want to read you something here. Break their lineage, break their roots, break their connections, and break their origins. That's a quote from a Chinese government document on how to deal with the Uyghur Muslim population of Xinjiang province.
This is one of the greatest human rights atrocities in the world right now. This is well over a million people locked up in what the DOD is calling concentration camps. And this is ethnic cleansing on a whole new level.
Isabel Jung is a correspondent for Vice on HBO. She has a new documentary out for Vice News called They Come For Us at Night, China's Missing Muslims, looking at the forced, quote, re-education of Uyghurs in China. UN officials estimate that there may be as many as 2 million people in these camps, but it's hard to get an exact number because that part of China is so tightly under wraps.
The region of Xinjiang, sort of one of the pillars of what the Chinese government is doing in that area at the moment, is implementing the world's most sophisticated surveillance state. And that is in part to control the population that is living there. And it's also to prevent information from leaking out.
To make this documentary, Isabel had to sneak inside China doing this work undercover.
So what we decided to do is go in as tourists, you know, travel bloggers kind of bumbling around in the hopes that we could have a little bit more freedom and actually get closer to the truth as to what is happening there. So we went in twice over the course of 5 months. We went in January and then we went back in May. I went in with just my one colleague. We took one handheld camera with us and then the rest of what we were holding is hidden cameras.
So this took, as one sees in this episode of yours, I mean, you took some real risks, didn't you?
It was a real risk. You know, the risks of getting caught with that equipment in the most sensitive region in China is being faced with charges of espionage. So, I mean, you've got to weigh up the risks with the rewards. And this is such a story that I don't feel like is getting the international attention that it needs right now and is incredibly important just on a pure scale level.
The Department of Defense in the U.S. has declared these concentration camps, obviously a term that is highly charged at this moment in the U.S. because of what's happening on our border.
Yeah, I mean, this is most likely the largest mass extrajudicial detention of any people since the Holocaust. This is over a million people put inside these camps, you know, which the government is saying are vocational training centers. But from firsthand testimonies of people that we've spoken to, both within and outside the country, these are places where they are taken and forced to be for an undisclosed period of time when they're not charged with anything, but they are taught absolute outright loyalty to the Chinese Communist Party.
And that starts increasingly at a very, very young age with little kids.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most harrowing parts of kind of looking into this story was that so many Uyghurs that we were talking to outside the country were telling us that they've had to part with their children and those children are being taken to state-run institutions and essentially being brought up as orphanages. We kind of went on this search to try and find what happens to the children of both people who are living abroad and people who have been sent to detention. And what we're finding is that one of the most effective ways in which the government can ensure that the next generation is entirely loyal to the Chinese Communist Party is by keeping them under state control in orphanages or in state care.
You speak with a woman whose story is very harrowing, who's left the province, but whose children have been put into some of these orphanages. If you could, just tell us what her story is.
Yeah, so Kelbinor, a lady we spoke to in Istanbul, is one of a growing number of people who have left Xinjiang. She left in 2016 with one of her children. She actually left to give birth in Turkey. She wasn't able to get passports for her children, her five children at the time. So she had to leave them in Xinjiang thinking that her husband would go back and pick them up in a few weeks' time. And her husband was arrested and we assume in detention at the moment. She hasn't been able to contact them. She hasn't been able to be in touch with her family members at all or her children for the last 3 years. And recently she actually got a video where she saw one of her daughters, Aisha, who appeared in what looks like a school she thinks could be an orphanage, which shows, you know, that her daughter is alive. It's the video of her kind of learning Chinese. You can see kind of bunk beds in the background. This video essentially led us on a search to try and find not only Aisha, her daughter, but also to uncover whether these rumors are true that all these kids are being taken away from their parents and put in these state-run orphanages.
And these are facilities, if I can add, when you show this footage, it shows like paintings or murals of Minnie and Mickey Mouse and all on the entrances. They have this sort of ostensibly childlike quality to them, but they are essentially being imprisoned in these places.
Yeah, I mean, they are huge, huge structures. We were actually able to identify them partly from satellite imagery because you can see they all do kind of have the same aesthetic. So you can see these like brightly patterned things on the ground. You can see these kind of castle-like turrets, and you can see these big walls around them. So that was kind of how we were able to GPS out where we wanted to go and how we could try and get to these particular buildings.
And so you follow this footage to, is it the town of Hotan?
Hotan, yeah.
And you actually go there.
Yeah, we did. So we went back again to this time to the city of Hotan. Obviously, the risks are even higher this time because we know that we're on the government radar. But we were able to get there. We were able to kind of map out where we thought these buildings were. And we were kind of able to get to some of them. And obviously not get inside them, but we were kind of able to go around the exteriors and kind of film them again with our hidden cameras and talk to people on the ground about what these might be and what might be going on inside.
What is the official Chinese party line about why these tactics are necessary?
They say that this is a security threat. Over the last decade or so, there have been a spate of terrorist attacks and violent riots in the region itself. Just a handful of them, I would add, but that is in itself kind of justification that they have used to crack down on an entire region. It's also in a very important geographical location. It borders 8 different countries. This is a region the size of Alaska, and it's a crucial location for part of China's global economic ambitions in terms of their One Belt, One Road strategy.
For Americans who are only now being exposed to issues like this, what do you hope will come of an episode like this?
I mean, I think the first thing is awareness. I mean, there's so many people that I talk to who have been working on this project for the last 6 months, have actually been obsessed with this story for the last decade or so, and people don't even know who the Uyghurs are. And I think that's just coming into consciousness, but I mean, it's still not really on the international agenda. And I would also say that the reason that people might not necessarily know about it is because it is so damn hard to report from that region. So I hope that it does bring some awareness as to what's happening to this population and that the international community puts some pressure on China to rethink their policies.
All right, that Vice News Tonight episode is called They Come For Us At Night, China's Vanishing Muslims. Isabel Yeung, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
On the Billboard music charts of 2019, rock and roll is barely making a dent. But it doesn't look like Hollywood's gotten the memo based on several major releases from the past couple years.
Bismillah, no, we will not let you go.
Let him go!
Bismillah.
Bohemian Rhapsody, about the life of Freddie Mercury and Queen, was a massive hit last year, grossing over $900 million worldwide. Summer, the Elton John biopic Rocket Man has been a more modest success, bringing in around $160 million globally. And now the filmmakers behind Yesterday are hoping that Beatlemania is still kicking nearly 50 years after the Beatles released their final album, but this film isn't telling the story of the Fab Four. Instead, it's set in a world where nobody remembers the band ever existed, except for Jack, played by Himesh Patel. Yesterday follows Jack as he attempts to become a rock star by presenting classics like Hey Jude and Let It Be as his own songs.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking.
Sorry, love, I'll get it.
Good start, though. Very pretty.
I have a couple film critics with me here in the studio to discuss these movies and whether any of them are as good as their soundtracks. Rafer Guzman is a film critic for Newsday and for us here at The Takeaway. Hey, Rafer.
Hey, how are you?
Great. And Karen Hahn is an entertainment reporter for Polygon. Thanks for being here, Karen.
Hey, lovely to be here.
All right, Rafer, I mentioned the premise of Yesterday, which requires a certain suspension of disbelief from the audience. Did you buy into the plot device?
Well, I think you might get sort of two different kinds of people that are going to appreciate Yesterday. I think one is your casual rock fan, music fan, someone who knows the Beatles like the way most people do, and they sort of enjoy the idea that the Beatles could suddenly vanish and that one guy could be able to pass off, you know, that this great, 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 you know, canon of songs as his own work. I think if you're a sort of a amateur Beatles buff like I am, a former rock critic, your mind kind of can't start helping but go to these sort of detailed places like, okay, now wait, are you saying that in that case, Pet Sounds wouldn't exist either by the Beach Boys because that means Rubber Soul wouldn't exist and so on. You know, what about Tommy by The Who? Mm-hmm. Does that mean we're getting rid of all of, you know, popular music? So if you're kind of a cranky, you know, old rocker like myself, I think you're going to get a little caught up in the details. But I still think it's a pretty fun, sweet, enjoyable film.
You liked it. All right. How about you, Karen? Not so much.
Unfortunately, no. I really do like the premise. I think it's very like weird and funny. But at the same time, I had a little bit of the cranky response to it where I was like, I don't think they've necessarily thought out all the ramifications that this would have. But even beyond that, I feel like a lot of the problems with the movie stem from the fact that it's kind of pulling from a rom-com playbook that's at least two decades old. Not to give too much away, but it is a very kind of will they, won't they situation where Jack's manager is his childhood best friend. They've known each other for 20 years and she's obviously romantically interested in him. Just the fact that she's been clinging to this for 20 years and all it takes is this one turnaround to kind of justify how much time she spent on him and really how poorly that he's treated her because she's driven him to gigs because he can't drive. She's carried all his gear around and she's basically devoted her life to him. The better part of her life to him with kind of no dividends on that.
All right. So the director, Danny Boyle, directed Yesterday. He's also known for movies like Trainspotting, Slumdog Millionaire. Visually, what's he doing to capture the songs in this movie?
I think that might be one objection that I had is this doesn't seem like Danny Boyle's strongest effort. Danny Boyle is, I think, maybe in his mid-50s, and he comes from more of a punk and post-punk background, which is why I think Trainspotting works so well. I mean, that was such a decade-defining, generation-defining mm-hmm. movie. I think in this film, he is trying to be a little jaunty and light, and you get some kind of funny tilted angles here and there. And, you know, and
funny
you get,
tilted angles.
Yeah. You know, I sort of noticed that. Like, I remember kind of thinking, like, why are we at a tilt on this particular, you know, moment? I don't know, really. It adds a little energy. I thought he might have played around a little bit more with some of the Beatles tropes, like, you know, like Hard Day's Night with all that kind of fast motion, antic jumping and running and stuff that the Beatles did. There's not that much going on here visually, I guess I would say.
And he's got pretty big shoes to fill, given Julie Taymor directed Across the Universe, which is not that long ago. I guess it depends on how old you are. But that was visually a stunning film, which, I mean, I really did love that film. Karen, are you a fan of that film? Have you seen it?
I will admit I haven't seen it recently, but I remember when I saw it when it came out, I was absolutely blown away by the visuals, which is, as Rafer was saying, kind of one of the things that lets Yesterday down. There's not that much going on very interestingly, and I feel like part of that has to do with the fact that the music is almost incidental. It's the gimmick that something has disappeared and this romantic comedy is built around it that's at the center, whereas something like Rocketman, for instance, is a musical, and the musical numbers do kind of take precedence over everything else.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, there is, I guess, a story to be told about the star of Yesterday, Himesh Patel. Filmmakers have said his casting was colorblind, which means that they didn't actually specify the race of the character in the script or the auditions. Karen, how big a deal is this?
I think it's a pretty big deal in so much as this is one of the first times that at least I've seen a blockbuster where a person of color is the lead and also presented as a romantic interest without kind of any trappings around that to qualify it. And I also think it's a big deal that in reading the reviews that my peers have written, nobody who, say, like me, dislike the movie has pointed at him as like the problem of it. He's terrific and everyone uniformly seems to agree that he really is a star.
Is his background, or should his character's racial cultural background, the fact that this is a South Asian man, British Indian, I guess, do you think that should have been played up more in terms of the plot of this movie, Rafer?
I don't really think it would have had any bearing on it. There are moments when you think to yourself that maybe they could have done something a little cute, given the Beatles, you know, Maharishi phase, something like that. But I think that was probably a wise choice on the filmmaker's part not to go there, even if it had been something that was, you know, fairly good-natured or just kind of cheeky or just kind of sly. I think it works better without any of that stuff. I think it works better as him just being you know, kind of a middle-class English kid. You know, we do see his parents. We heard them in the clip earlier that you played, where he's trying to play Let It Be, and people keep coming over, and the doorbell keeps ringing, and no one's you know, sort of bowled over by the majesty of Let It Be. They just sort of keep going on with their day, and he's trying to play it for him. His two parents are there, so you know that he's from what seems to be maybe immigrant parents. But that's all that's touched on, really. They could really be, you know, anyone's annoying parents of any ethnicity, really. And I think that's a good thing. I think that was a good move on the film's part.
As I mentioned earlier, yesterday is part of a recent rock movie trend of sorts. Why do you think Hollywood is going back to music from the 60s and 70s right now? Is it just the boomers who are showing up at theaters?
You know, I think it's one of these things where I think the boomers still have a bit of a stranglehold on Hollywood. You know, if you're a successful screenwriter, director, producer, chances are you're of a certain age and also quite possibly male. And that means you're probably a rocker. This is the stuff that you grew up on. And it's funny, too, because there's been, even beyond the 60s and 70s, there's been a kind of a trend of rock and pop movies in general. Her Smell by Alex Ross Perry, Teen Spirit, Vox Lux with Natalie Portman, Wild Rose, which just came out, I think, last week. It's a little odd that this whole wave has been going, especially, you know, as you said, rock music in particular, it really seems to be on the decline. I mean, only Ed Sheeran, who's actually in Yesterday, seems to be surviving really well, you know. But I, you know, to answer your question, I do think it's kind of a boomer thing. I think, you know, they're still the ones in power. That's why we're seeing all these rock docs, you know, about Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen and David Crosby. I mean, it's all still coming out, I think, because they're the ones who are calling the shots.
So basically, a lot of guys that we're seeing on screen. Who are some women whose music you think Hollywood should be taking on?
Well, one of the interesting things to come out of the Rocketman press tour has been that director Dexter Fletcher expressed interest in doing, say, a Madonna biopic, which I think could be incredible given the right, I guess, massaging. And kind of, I guess, to harken back to Rafer's point, I do think it's partially an overall wave of cultural nostalgia, which is kind of taking over both film and TV. Things like Stranger Things or even just the soundtrack of the Guardians of the Galaxy movies, they're all harkening back 40, 50 years to pull from what we remember of that time.
All right, so both Bohemian Rhapsody and Rocketman, about Elton John's life, they're both made with the permission of their still living subjects. Karen, first, does this make these films less compelling because they're authorized?
I don't think it makes them any less compelling because they're authorized. I think it really just has to do with how they tackle the subject matter. Like, Rocketman is, you can tell that Elton John has had a hand in it, but it's still great. Not so much so for Bohemian Rhapsody, even though the music is still good.
Yeah, you know, Rocketman, I actually thought surprisingly benefited from Elton John's insights. You know, the one thing I thought was great in that film was this idea of Elton John sort of never being able to get over the wounds to his inner child, which I think really resonate through that film. And I think that's because Elton John probably really, you know, told the filmmakers that this was a big deal to him. And I think that worked actually pretty well in the film. Unlike, let's say, in Bohemian Rhapsody, which I think worked less well because of Queen's involvement. But yeah, I liked Rocketman for that reason.
Rafer Guzman is a film critic for Newsday and us here at The Takeaway, and Karen Hahn is an entertainment reporter for Polygon. Thank you both for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's all for us today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Arun Vanigopal in this week for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.